infrastructure. What we have here is a framework, but only as good as the funding and implementation to follow. How does that work? Will the Pew Foundation and Systemic put their considerable assets and skills behind the plan? How will these initiatives be incentivized? How will the high-income countries respond to changes that may go against established interests? How will low-income countries afford to instigate these changes without substantial assistance? Will the UN agencies, the World Bank, and other international and national funding entities buy into the plan, take a piece, and make it real? There are many national and international groups committed to solve the plastic problem. What if, like a school of fish in the ocean, they all turned at once in the same direction, pooled their resources, and accepted individual integration as part of the whole? There's an excellent example of how it can work. Over the past decade, the Pew Foundation has assumed a powerful lead in the campaign for marine protected areas, a plan that persuaded the UN, many governments, and other environmental groups to join in a shared vision to protect ocean national resources by direct political action, regulatory power, and appropriate finance. It is one of the most successful collective actions for ocean conservation to date. And here we go again, with a new opportunity to execute a transformational plan for plastic. After the World Ocean Summit in Lisbon in July, a group of 11 private philanthropies announced the Protecting Our Planet Challenge, a pledge of $5 billion in support for ocean sustainability goals to be achieved by 2030. Those goals were lofty and aspirational. In the announcement press release, the word plastic was not mentioned. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
Listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 10 a.m. It's Thursday. It's time for American Standoff with your host, Jacqueline Keeler. Stay tuned.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's real. Bury my heart in wounded knee, deep in the earth.
Good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler with American Standoff. I am your host, and I have a new show again this week. And this week it's not so much topical about something newsworthy that's happening, but it's actually about the news coverage itself. And so, as you know, we've been, this show started, first aired on the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. And then each week we look at sort of how, looking at the political divide in this country and its origins, which I often reference my book, Standoff, which goes into much greater detail on my sort of ideas about the different origin stories between colonists, and I do view the United States as a colony that is occupying the homelands of Native nations, and then I contrast how sort of the algorithmic nature of the functions that go into a colonial origin story, how those significantly differ from those that go into a people, which is a Native people. And so you can, I've reviewed that before on the show, so, but I will go into that again, because I do think it plays a role in the ability of media, particularly mainstream white media, to understand what's going on in this country today. And I think it's actually, I play clips every week, and I kind of go over, sort of elements of how the news coverage is going, and also so that you can hear someone else's voice besides mine in an episode. But, I often find it very frustrating to listen to these, because I hear white reporters really struggling with trying to articulate what's going on, and I think they're missing a piece there, because, and I'll go into that more into the show. So once again, as I always open the show, this show is about examination of the ramifications of this political divide, and in the country that's going on now. It's why the show is called American Standoff, and its origins, and that myself, as a citizen of a Native nation and descendant of a second Native nation, I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and my father is Yankton Sioux and a tribal member there. Two nations, the Dakota and the Diné, that preexisted the occupation by the United States. So I do see that the fallout would happen on January 6, 2021, when thousands of supporters of former President Trump attempted to storm the Capitol and protest, to deny the election of Biden and the loss of Trump. I do see this as an outgrowth of that story of colonialism, violence, and white supremacy that began this country, and that is still the defining features of it, of what I call the origin story. And certainly, I often point out, to bring this back to an Oregon sort of basis, our state also experiences the same thing. 2 weeks before the Capitol was stormed in D.C., our Capitol in Salem was also breached by armed insurrectionists defying COVID restrictions. So today on American Standoff, we are looking at how the media fumbles covering white supremacist extremism. And so we're going to look at both sidism, or what some people call false objectivity in media, and how really this feeds the political divide in this country by refusing to name the problem, or actually being unable to, because lacking the proper framework to understand American history, and equivocating protesting unequal treatment by minorities with attempts to violently overthrow small-d democracy by primarily white Republicans. So obscuring this, the nature of this, is not helping us. So we'll get into that more. Let's open with Tom Hartman making this point on his show a year after the January 6th insurrection. I forgot that I have to play the audio, but let me see here.
Overthrowing democracy is not the same thing as protesting police violence, contrary to what you may have read in all the responses to my tweet yesterday afternoon. As Biden told us, we stand at an inflection point in history. The fate of democracy here and around the world is actually hanging in the balance. And so today's rant is titled, over at HarvardReport.com, is titled, Sedition Day, Overthrowing Democracy is Not the Same Thing as Protesting Police Violence. So today is the anniversary of hundreds of Capitol Police, House and Senate staffers, members of Congress, and people who work in the seat of our nation's government, you know, the food service workers, janitors, right across the board, successfully fighting back the first violent assault on a congressional session in the history of our republic. This has never happened before. House followers and their fellow travelers, including 139 Republicans in the House and 8 in the Senate, tried their best to end our way of government. They incited, participated in, and are now justifying the first violent attack on Congress since the Constitution was signed 235 years ago. And they failed. But yesterday, Merrick Garland gave a speech to the nation. I thought he said a lot of great things. You know, he said, we're going to hold people accountable for January 6th, no matter who they are, no matter where they are. The one thing, which you would just expect, you know, he said, you know, we're going to follow the facts wherever they lead. Great. He, however, left far more ambiguous the question of what will be done with those members of Congress who conspired to overthrow our government. And then he went into this really weird thing. He started talking about other kinds of crime in the United States. Merrick Garland did, our attorney general. He said, we have all seen that Americans who serve and interact with the public at every level, many of whom make our democracy work every day, have been unlawfully targeted with threats of violence and actual violence. He talked about election officials and election workers. Okay, that's Republicans going after them. Airline flight crews, that's Trump pumpers. School personnel, Trump pumpers. Journalists, Trump pumpers. Local elected officials, U.S. senators and representatives. All of these people have been, you know, basically attacked by right-wingers. But then he gets into this weird exception. There was this one guy who went out and killed the husband or the son of a federal judge. Turns out that the guy who did that had no political agenda whatsoever. He had been before that judge. He didn't like the way she ruled. And he was African-American. And already his picture is popping up on right-wing websites. Like, hey, Merrick Garland called out this guy. And his crime was completely unrelated to January 6th. So it's totally weird that Garland would mention this and then follow it with this sentence. Because, you know, he's just cataloged all these crimes being committed against Americans by Republicans, by Trump bumpers, and by Trump himself. And then he says, these acts and threats of violence are not associated with any one set of partisan or ideological views. What? Seriously? I mean, I get it. He's trying to appear even-handed and all that, but, you know, no. So I tweeted about this yesterday. Yesterday afternoon, after I got off the air, after I'd finished hearing all of Merrick Garland's speech, I tweeted, I can't believe I just heard Garland say essentially that political violence is a problem on both sides. This both sidesism is a cancer in our political and media arenas that simply gives more license to neo-fascists who advocate, threaten, and then use violence. I'm astonished. That's what I tweeted. And somebody must have, or Twitter's algorithm or whatever, somehow got into the right-wingosphere. And all these trolls came out. And, you know, a lot of people who have, like, you know, 16 followers or 3 followers, you know, even some presumably even foreign trolls, came out and started posting pictures of riots in Portland, right? And riots around the country that had to do with Black Lives Matter and Antifa. And there were actual riots and there was actual property destruction. Those people were not trying to overthrow our government. I have got it. I mean, you know, it's amazing. In fact, I encourage you to look at my tweet from yesterday afternoon and just look at the responses to it. It's mind-boggling. The new Republican strategy is to say, oh, you're upset that we tried to overthrow the government on January 6th? Well, what about people who burned down buildings because they didn't like black people, unarmed black people being killed by police? Isn't it the same thing? I mean, it's just breathtaking. But, you know, it's also a variation on what Merrick Garland did yesterday.
So that was Tom Hartman talking about the sort of both sidism and the way, and this approach, and as a way of sort of making... you know, making it seem okay what's happening right now in this country, and to sort of redirect attention from the real aspect of this, which is about white supremacy, right? They don't want to name it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to alienate that group. And I'm going to get more into the whole alienation issue as well. And another one of the things I brought up in the sort of description of the show, which is climate change, the issue of climate change, because research has recently come out that shows that these sort of journalistic norms of objectivity, often interpreted by editors, reporters, which give at least 2 sides to every story, no matter if one is based on lies or self-interest and the other is based on science or facts, has been feeding climate denialism as well. And so, you know, they give climate change deniers like twice the amount of coverage and platform them far more than they do actual scientists doing research on this issue, is what the study found. And it's a 2020 study. And I put a link to it in the into the episode description. And so what they found was that this practice has lent legitimacy to those who deny climate change, leading readers to believe that denial is more than a fringe stance, right? So so the same sort of, when you see the sort of parity given to these two different sides, ignores the substantial differences of what they actually mean, the implications of them. And and I also give the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of both sides, which is that the media are public figures crediting the other side of a cause, action, or idea to seem fair or only for the sake of argument when the credibility of that side may be unmerited. The term is also used to describe public figures equivocating about a seemingly condemnable action, saying that people on both sides are equally responsible for that action, which is pretty much what we've seen going on here. And so the I want to play another sort of clip. But also, actually, I want to I always start the show out by acknowledging doing a land acknowledgement, which I'm going to write more about the sort of politics of land acknowledgement and what they imply and mean. I've been working on a piece on that for a while now. So once again, I'd like to invite you also to call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. This is a call-in show, and I would love to hear your thoughts on the sort of the way the media gives parity to very unequal analyses of any issue. So I always like to greet you with in my own language. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. And in the Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves to our clans. Kia'ani Nishle, my clan is Kia'ani, and I am born for Bashashin, the Ihantawan Dakota people, the Yankton Sioux people. And so I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, is located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz bands, Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes. And also the question I ask every episode of American Standoff is that in the more than a year that has passed since January 6, 2021, it's now going on a year and, I don't know, 9 months, when we all saw the Capitol stormed, what have we learned? What have we learned from that experience? And as Americans, as people who rely on an intact democratic system for our own safety. And what I wanted to look at was, what we're going to listen to next is a statement made by Naomi Oreskes. She's a Harvard professor of the history of science, and she was a speaker in 2018 at George Washington School of Media and Public Affairs in D.C. on a panel called Media Objectivity and the Scientific Consensus, which was also put on by the Social Science Research Council. And she's a Harvard professor of history of science, and she argues that attempts to appear objective and balanced have led media organizations to give equal coverage to scientifically backed evidence and disinformation. So, and that these attempts to add objectivity have led to the privileging of falsehoods at the expense of scientific consensus and weakened public confidence in science. So let's listen to what she had to say on this panel.
Two things. First of all, we know, we've documented it, that for decades, the mainstream media's notion of objectivity and balance led them to give greatly disproportionate attention to, you know, the climate deniers, or to present representatives of the tobacco industry or the Cato Institute as if they were appropriate counterweights to the scientific community. And frankly, that still goes on, even with the latest...
under pressure by these groups, as you say, who are trying to undermine scientific consensus and made to feel that they are not scientific consensus and made to feel that they are not being fair if they don't put on these opposing voices.
Correct, and journalists have continuing to do that even today. And even I've spoken to journalists, and I hate to criticize journalists because, because I feel like the mainstream media is good to me. I get quoted a lot. My op-eds run in many prestigious newspapers, so I don't want to bite the hand that feeds me. But nevertheless, you know, this is still continuing even now. And the other thing has to do with the spectrum of the mainstream media, because yes, I acknowledge there is a tremendous amount of outstanding reporting in the Wall Street Journal, but it's also true that on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, disinformation about science-based facts has been perpetuated for more than 20 years. And this is a tricky space because, of course, the opinion page, the editorial page, is the place where it's appropriate to express opinions. But when these editorials make factual claims that are untrue, then that does a lot of damage. And Fortune, Forbes, the Wall Street Journal.
So, sorry about that. I had these sort of running sort of fast. So, I'm going to try to make sure it's at the right speed here. That was Naomi Oreskes, the Harvard professor of history of science, and the impact that this sort of allegedly even-handed coverage by giving equal time to patently unsupported perspectives, is the harm that it does on us trying to address major issues like climate change, which is absolutely crucial to be able to deal with that in order to, billions of people's lives are at stake, communities are at stake. So many, many communities that did not even benefit from the factors that led to climate change, industialization and heavy fossil fuel use and carbon emissions. And so, that's what she was talking about there. And So once again, this is American Standoff, a live talk radio show. So please do feel free to call in if you want to be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187, and I'm Jacqueline Humer, your host. So as I mentioned earlier, part of the reason I wanted to cover this is the frustration I have felt as I've gone through and listened to reporting done about this issue. That's the main topic of the show, which is the political divide in this country. It's been really frustrating to hear fellow journalists, mostly white, who really, really have a difficult time articulating what's going on, because this means that they can't, if they can't understand what's going on, because they have this, a lot of their understanding of what America is and what it means is not only fed by historical inaccuracy. My book Stand Up, I go through a lot of the history, how the history of the Revolutionary War, a lot of what we understand about it and what we're taught is actually propaganda. It's not really, it's not based in what really happened. And I've gone through that history point by point in the show before. So this really, they come to this moment, this momentous moment in history, incapable of articulating what's going on, because they're using propaganda to understand what America is, right? And they are unwilling to really come to terms with the history of white supremacy, and this really makes it almost impossible for them. And also the way in which this first clip I'm going to play, I love Here and Now. It's a great show. But in this case, they sort of dropped the ball. They allowed the Republican commenter to really try to misdirect the audience to something completely unrelated, to talking points, And I think this platforming of talking points is and treating it as an equal sort of response to what's going on with the MAGA Republicanism that's rising in the party, and is opposed by members of members of the Republican Party. It's not voters, but Republican officials, so this coverage I thought really missed the mark, and this was actually aired yesterday. The segment aired yesterday. They're discussing Tuesday night's primary results in New Hampshire and how election deniers are winning primaries as Republicans debate national abortion ban. So let's just play that and let's discuss it.
Two election deniers won their Republican primaries in New Hampshire last night.
So let's hear from a pair of smart political strategists. Republican Alice Stewart is a veteran of several GOP presidential campaigns. Alice, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Hi, Jane.
And Democrat Arnie Arneson is a former politician. She ran for governor in New Hampshire. She now hosts a radio show there. Arnie, good to have you as well.
It's a pleasure, Anthony.
So let's start with this race in New Hampshire. First of all, in the race for the U.S. House in the 1st District, 25-year-old Carolyn Leavitt, who worked in the Trump White House, won her primary. She'll face Democratic Congressman Chris Pappas in November. But let's focus on this close contest in the Senate primary. The AP has called the race for retired Army officer and election denier Don Bolduc. He'll face the incumbent Democrat Maggie Hassan in November. Here's a bit of what Bolduc said last night.
We are now going to rally around the circle, unity, freedom, liberty, and together.
Among other things, Bolduc claims the 2020 election was stolen. He suggested the FBI should be abolished. Arnie, incumbent Democratic Senator Hassan was seen as vulnerable. Now she's running against a hard right conspiracy theorist in a moderate state. Is this result pretty good news for her?
Oh, my God, it's such a gift. But it's more than a gift, because let's also remember that the gentleman that won the Senate race, Bolduc, described Chris Sununu this way. He discussed
the mayor. That's the governor of New Hampshire. Sorry.
That's the governor of New Hampshire. Sorry. Governor Chris Sununu this way, as a communist Chinese sympathizer, and that the Sununu family business supports terrorism. That's who the Republicans nominated for their candidate for U.S. Senate.
And Arnie, we should stress that Sununu is a Republican as well. I'm sorry to cut you off.
But then you also see the Republicans, with Mitch McConnell supporting them, spending about $4 to $5 million in support, again, of this more moderate Republican. And Governor Chris Sununu, the Republican, supported what they packaged as a more moderate Republican. Hmm. Despite all that money, despite all those hands-on on that other Republican, Bolduc won.
Right.
He won with very little money, but what Bolduc represents is the new face of the Republican Party. It is MAGA, it is Free State, it is Libertarian. All the money in the world isn't going to make a difference, because not only was Bolduc successful in his U.S. Senate bid, but then when you look at the two congressional races, it is a trifecta. They all represent that extreme right wing, and no matter what Sununu did, he could not persuade the base to listen to him.
Arnie, I'm just going to jump in because I want to hear from Alice.
I hope that we can pivot away from election denying and criticizing a governor and focus on inflation. I was in New Hampshire last week. I was impressed with the large number of yard signs. Their enthusiasm is very high, but also people that live there. I know their fuel prices, their home heating prices are through the roof, and that is something that is felt by every person in the state of New Hampshire and across this country. So to the degree that these candidates, whether it's Bolduc or the two congressional candidates, Leavitt, as well as Burns, can focus on economy and crime and education. That's what I would strongly recommend, and not continue the rhetoric they use to win their primary races.
Well, clearly, there's no denying the fact that Donald Trump is the titular head of his base of the Republican Party. But there are many Republicans who want to steer clear of fighting his past grievances and focus on the issues of the day. Again, that is inflation, the economy, jobs, and crime. And to the degree that we can pivot to those issues and remind people that their housing prices are high, grocery prices are high, and the everyday cost of living is high, those are the issues that are going to motivate voters.
So that was the coverage, yesterday's coverage by Here and Now on NPR, that about the Tuesday primary wins. You're described as a trifecta win of MAGA supporting Trumpsters in New Hampshire, which is described as a moderate state. I have actually lived and voted in New Hampshire as a student at Dartmouth College. I don't know if it's moderate or not. It seems a bit Republican to me, but at the time. But as a Native person in an almost entirely white state that had driven out all its tribal people, I don't know. I felt a little not like represented there. I found this really frustrating because even though the former Democratic governor candidates, she was very well spoken, they kept cutting her off and trying to talk over her. But they gave the Republican, Alice Stewart, a veteran Republican strategist, plenty of time to repeat her talking points over and over again and almost completely try to bury the story, which is that these people are all election deniers, and that what really garnered their support from the Republican base that her party represents was election denialism and all the other things that Trump represents. And which includes white supremacy, and so, you know, trying to steer it again to trying to sort of attack attack the Democratic leadership and hang inflation and all these things around their necks when, you know, we just came out of a worldwide pandemic, you know, a major source of fossil fuels has been cut off with Putin and Ukraine. I mean, these are factors beyond any national government's control, and certainly the response by the Trump administration certainly helped wasn't helpful in stopping the spread of the virus, and offered recommending horse tranquilizers, all these crazy things that the Republican base did during the pandemic, certainly helped lengthen and deepen the effects of the pandemic, which is being dealt with today. So it's just the way in which they don't question her talking points, the way they don't, and they gave her plenty of time. And we're practically speaking over the Democratic Arison spokesperson. So that was just very frustrating for me to listen to. And but this is the next piece I'm going to play is a little different. So this is coming from Slate magazine, Slate podcast, and they're looking at it's called the semi-fascist edition, and they are looking at Biden when he gave his speech, was September 8th, when he gave a speech about anti-democratic elements of the electorate, and they also discussed, and I didn't really include this discussion at all, but the roots of the Jackson, Mississippi water crisis, in which the folks who are being quoted basically don't understand what caused what caused the Jackson crisis. They have a really hard time naming racism. I mean, with a primarily black community in Mississippi, they seem to be really struggling to name that racism might be the cause of the lack of water and infrastructure in the city. It's extraordinary. It's really torturous to listen to, actually. And so, but let's listen to this clip about their discussion of Biden's use of semi-fascists.
President Biden last week in Philadelphia made his most explicit statement yet about what has happened to the Republican Party, calling the MAGA Republican faction of the party, and how big that faction is, what it's composed of, is, I guess, a matter for debate, but he called it semi-fascism. So what is fascism and semi-fascism? When Biden says this, what does he mean? If you look at traditional definitions of fascism, it's a belief system that society has been corrupted, usually by outside forces. It needs to be purged and controlled. That there has to be a charismatic leader who is not bound by traditional structures of authority, usually a male charismatic leader, to keep everyone in line and purge these disruptive outsider elements, to clean society, because the need to clean society is greater than the need to abide by these weak and stupid and feckless rules that we've been abiding by. Is that what Biden is saying?
I mean, maybe. I feel a little worried about these terms getting thrown around and also a little confused. I mean, right, like, I was trying to think what work semi-fascism did for him that authoritarian tendencies wouldn't have accomplished. Like, that I feel like I understand what that is, and I feel comfortable with it, right? It's like anti-democratic. I think it has a lot of the elements that you just laid out. Is it different from fascism at this point? I mean, fascism historically we associate with, you know, Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, and like, that's pretty easy for me. I get it. They did a particular thing at this moment in history that was really disastrous and had all the anti-democratic, super aggrieved, like, terrible attributes.
And I guess what I find so, two pieces of Trumpism that I find so disconcerting and worrisome are not so much the authoritarian authoritarian pieces as the willingness to subvert the election, which I don't think is authoritarian, it's something else, and this demonization of outsiders and this sense that you have, there's some people who are more American than others, and it's okay to treat these people who are less American as being less American, and that there's sort of a right of certain people who make basically white people who've been here for a while to decide what America is and glean the finest parts of the crop and take the nicest bits of the roast for themselves. And that part I find alarming. Those are separate from the authoritarian streak to me.
Is fascism or semi-fascism a useful label for
different? Well, I don't think anyone knows what it means.
Sign me up in that group.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. You expect a president to say things bluntly when America is attacked. You expect a president to say things bluntly, you know, in the course of political campaigns, and that's, of course, what this comes in. But this is bluntness of a different order. But the fact is, it's become a sloppy word. And so if you're trying to say something clean and crisp and blunt, it seems to work against that because the word has lost a lot of its meaning.
Then what is it that you're supposed to say about Trump and Trumpism? I mean, everything has been said about Trump. Defining what the Trumpist movement is, less has been said, but almost everything has been said about that. What is it that you could say that would be strong and clear? I would like you to tell me what's better. Emily, do you think there's a rhetorical way to make these points?
I mean, I think it's important to talk about defending democracy against real threats. I am not excited about writing off groups of people. And I think in his Labor Day speech, Biden, if you read it, you can sort of imagine different sizes of groups. You can like accuse him of talking about 50% of the country when he was talking about extreme MAGA Republicans, or you can think that he just meant like the Republicans in Congress who support former President Trump. But in general, I just don't understand the political benefit of saying a whole potentially large group of people is like evil, which was effectively what he was doing in some way, shape, or form. But my main point is, I don't think the president of the United States should be talking in a way that opens up the possibility that he's then going to be accused of writing off nearly half the electorate.
I would just like to note the kind of errant deep hypocrisy, which is that Trump made so many speeches that were demonizing groups of people.
100%.
All the time. I mean, just his demonization of people was astounding.
And abhorrent.
Okay, so that was a clip from September 8th that was on Slate's podcast, The Gabfest, which is, I see, voted favorite political podcast by Apple Podcast listeners. And that Stephen Colbert says everybody should listen to Slate's Political Gabfest. And it's hosted by Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, and David Plotz. And I think Emily Bazelon was, and John Dickerson were sort of the ones responding to David Plotz. I thought David Plotz did a good job of really questioning some of her reasoning, although he did sort of agree with them at some point. But you can see that this is how I feel like my colleagues in the media, truly my white colleagues, really are not helping. You know, they're not helping us define the problem when they make arguments like this. It's, you know, basically having her say that that he's writing off like 50% of the country when he's talking about extreme MAGA Republicans. And she's not naming the fact that as I've gone through the demographic the demographics of the MAGA Republican, and it is primarily white Americans. And I noted a few episodes ago that just white Americans had voted in 2020 for president of the United States, that Trump would be president today. Yeah. And so it's all the people of color who are keeping him out of office. And I should say the one group of white Americans who do not vote Republican, who vote like 80% Democrat, are Jewish Americans. And so that certainly they still feel outside of white supremacy to a certain extent. And so she's obviously unwilling and incredibly sort of hostile to it. She I see Emily is writing for The Atlantic, magazine. But it's a real letdown. I mean, they just seem to be skirting around it. And when their voices are platformed in such a way, like on the most popular political podcast in the country, it's really concerning, and that we don't have folks who are willing to speak directly to what's at hand, because we need that sort of discussion. And so that's part of it. You know, one of the folks I love hearing from on Twitter discussing sort of pushing back on a lot of these issues is journalist Dan Rather. And I thought it'd be interesting to counterpoint this with his perspective on this issue and how to be objective as a journalist.
How do you stay objective in that situation as a journalist?
Well, I think it begins with the answer that no journalist can be totally objective, totally unbiased, every day, in every way, on every story. That the test of a journalist of integrity is over a reasonable length of time, how hard does he or she try to keep their own biases out, and how do they succeed? The critical point comes, and you've touched on it, when, as a journalist, you see something happening, you say to yourself, you know what, I'm a journalist, but I'm also, I'm an American, I'm a citizen, I'm a father, I'm a brother. And this is outrageous. This is not compatible with my conscience. That's the test point of trying to stay objective and try to stay unbiased. But, you know, as a lifetime journalist, I can say I can only speak for myself. You do the best you can, realizing you're going to make your mistakes. But sort of prizing those moments when you have said to yourself, you know, I've got to quit saying that I'm going to deal in false equivalent. It's one of the great dangers of journalism, false equivalent. Well, there's just as many voices on this side as there are on this.
Yeah, so that was veteran journalist Dan Rather discussing the issue and how it can slide into this sort of alleged objectivity can slide into false equivalency, where you're giving the sort of both sides, as I had referred to it earlier, where scientifically, as was noted by Professor Oreskes, that media organizations are giving equal coverage in the case of climate change through scientifically backed evidence and through disinformation, right? And largely backed by corporations. And I think that, as you may guess, the issue of corporate ownership plays a big role in this, right? I think, and many of you follow the media, but Politico was recently purchased by a German Trump supporter, so that you wonder how that's going to impact their coverage. And then there's been a lot of stuff in the Twitter sphere about how CNN is starting to trend right because just of the demographics of people who actually watch and subscribe to cable television. And so, so that's what's going on there. But let's listen to what I wanted to maybe get into a bit as well is some of the history of how we got here. Like, where did this concept of objectivism come from, and how has it been shaped by market forces? And so I have a thing here. Hopefully, this won't go over time.
People have been accusing the news of getting worse, more partisan, more divisive, more lurid. And as people accuse news outlets of slant, spin, bias, or outright fake news, it's worth asking, can the news ever be truly impartial? And where did the idea of objective news even come from? So today we're going to see if we can answer these questions in this Wisecrack edition on Can the News Be Objective? So we're going to use Merriam-Webster's definition of objectivity, which is the lack of favoritism toward one side or another and freedom from bias. In other words, to report the news objectively means to recount the goings-on of the world without a specific agenda to promote or a favorite politician to support. We also need to figure out where the idea of objective news comes from, because it's a fairly modern phenomenon. For most of Western history, print publications like pamphlets were just another method of the king or landowner passing down whatever he wanted his subjects to know, or a method for the church to communicate with the faithful. But this started changing in the 18th century as the philosophies of the Enlightenment worked their ways into all aspects of culture, including news publications. Just as artists and scientists used the Enlightenment principle of reason to explore the world untethered from God and the aristocracy, so too did news publications that sprung up to offer accounts of social and political affairs. And this offered a new perspective on the role of objectivity in the press, as the same Enlightenment principles that tried to understand the natural world without bias were used to understand society, or so they thought. Philosopher Terry Eagleton has discussed the complicated early days of the free press in his book, The Function of Criticism, which begins with an account of two of the earliest English papers, The Spectator and The Tatler. According to Eagleton, both of these papers used moral correction and satiric ridicule to offer criticisms of the aristocracy that would have previously gotten writers locked in a dungeon. At first glance, it would seem like this new freedom would enable an objective type of journalism that could inform regular citizens about current events. But, according to Eagleton, these publications were far from objective, and in fact, they largely served the purpose of the emerging bourgeoisie while creating an acceptable way to offer criticisms of the ruling class. What was even capable of being said, Eagleton notes, was defined by England's ruling bloc. The very ability to participate in the disinterested debate of English newspapers usually meant that one had to be a landowner too, meaning ironically that only those with an interest can be disinterested. In other words, the debate, disagreements, and coverage of these papers were all predicated on people who were impartially trying to grease the wheels of the society that kept them and their fellow landowners on top. While Eagleton was looking back in time at England's press in the 1700s, philosopher Soren Kierkegaard offered harsh criticism of Copenhagen's press that emerged during his lifetime 100 years later. But while Eagleton was critical of the European press for failing to offer a truly objective perspective on current events, Kierkegaard was critical of the papers in Copenhagen for being too objective. One of Kierkegaard's key philosophical tenets was that truth is subjectivity, which for him meant that for anything to be true, it had to elicit passion and commitment. Now that might sound a little bit strange, so follow with me for a bit. In terms of journalism, Kierkegaard thought that the lack of subjectivity in the press created a lack of passion and intensity in the public and led to an age of passionless reflection, where people would rather observe what was happening around them than take any active role in it. One of the effects of the supposed objective press, according to Kierkegaard, was that everyone reading the papers became one big anonymous group called the public. The news just became a form of general entertainment describing the world in a pseudo-objective way. Now, if this all sounds a little bit abstract, we can consider the work of Jon Stewart. As the host of The Daily Show, Jon Stewart embodied the opposite of the press that Kierkegaard hated so much precisely because he operated in a mode of subjectivity. As writer Matt Taibbi put it in the New York Times, some object to the characterization of Stewart as a journalist because he has opinions and isn't objective. But those people aren't to be taken seriously. Opinion can't be extracted from reporting. The only question is whether or not it's hidden. Taibbi points out that objectivity is a guise the press can hide behind to avoid responsibility. Unlike CNN's marketing initiative to put facts first, Stewart operated in a mode of pure subjectivity, letting his audience know his biases up front and breaking from the humor of his show to get passionate about issues he cared about, like healthcare for 9/11 first responders. It's not that facts don't exist, but simply hiding behind the facts to distance yourself from your own bias is, well, bad. So if Kierkegaard pointed all this out in the 19th century and Eagleton expanded on it over 35 years ago, why are we still so hung up on the promise of an objective form of journalism? The idea of objectivity in American journalism largely comes from the work of Walter Lippmann, a 20th century journalist and media critic who thought that journalists needed to incorporate the scientific method into their reporting. Lippmann thought that by presenting citizens with this more impartial news, that they would be better informed and the democratic process would be strengthened. While Lippmann seems to have been well-intentioned, the reason that objectivity in the news became so popular in the 20th century had little to do with democratic aspirations. Instead, the real driving force behind the push toward objectivity in the American media was America's most famous pastime, advertising. Because as the press grew into a full-fledged industry, advertising became the largest source of media revenue.
Today's news today, produced for Camel Cigarettes by NBC.
Carol Baldaski notes that 19th century advertisers wanted less criticism of public officials and reminded publishers that partisanship hurt circulation and consequently advertising revenues. So offering an objective perspective became code word for keeping everything vanilla for the widest audience possible. It's much like Kierkegaard predicted, that the press would turn individuals into one big anonymous public.
Okay, so that was a bit long. I'm sorry, I apologize for that. But it was, I wanted to really hit a lot of those aspects of why the media operates the way it does and why it's just completely inadequate to deal with our present situation as far as addressing rampant extremism. And I think that one of the things to, you know, so I wanted to bring this up because I almost forgot, is that, you know, it's just really frustrating to see, well, I brought this up earlier, but another thing that really spurred me on to want to do this show was Jay Rosen, NPR did a piece about polarization and about, it was titled, Americans have increasingly negative views of those in the other political party. This was published on August 13, 2022 by Domenico Montanaro. And it was interesting because it got a lot of feedback and the problem sort of equivocating these two things, like that is just that the problem is really polarization, not the issue that that one group is being misinformed and being led by outright lies, right? They don't want to frame it that way. And actually another inspiration for the show was Dame Magazine, which I do encourage you to check out. It is at damemagazine.com. They did on the 13th, they published a piece called It's Not Just Voters Driving Polarization, right? They write that as the GOP actively tries to dismantle our democracy with violence and fascistic laws, the media would have us believe it's just politics as usual and it's only deepening the divisions in this country, right? And so it's just extraordinary. I actually used as the image for this show an AP, Associated Press tweet, right, an image of their tweet that they put out on January 24th, 2021. And this is how they frame the present political divide. She thinks the election was stolen from Donald Trump. He believes what dozens of courts and officials have found, that Joe Biden is the rightful winner. They're trying to find common ground, but wonder whether they and the nation can do it, right? And this got a lot of response as well. It was, I think one of the responses was from Drew Gibson, who wrote, "Believe that something that is objectively false, he believes something grounded in reality and backed up by reams of evidence, will they be able to find common ground? No, because the woman has no interest in acknowledging truth. Stop propagating her delusions." And So it's just this attempt to try to create this sort of equivalency really misses the mark as far as dealing with our present situation. And this is coming from the Associated Press, right? I appreciate some of their reporting. I did have issues with the reporting around Standing Rock because they did the same thing. The Associated Press coverage of the dog attacks in Standing Rock Labor Day weekend 2016, the AP reporter led with the dogs being attacked rather than the fact that the dogs hired by Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the Dakota Access Pipeline, that the dogs had bitten a pregnant Lakota woman, you know, who was there protesting them digging up and trying to destroy artifacts that had been identified in a court filing by the tribe, and so that it wouldn't be a factor in stopping the pipeline. And so here you have the AP meeting with the dogs getting hurt, not with Native women being harmed by the dogs. And so it's so how the press views things, how they report on it really matters. And I've just been really this constant problem. with the way they just seem really unable to focus on what the actual issue is. The other aspect of it is, of course, the issue of advertising, right? And I mentioned before that now with the fall of advertising, the focus has been more on, you know, how do we retain our audiences, and for folks who companies, legacy media companies on cable TV, the audience is trending very old, right? It's elderly people, and most elderly people in this country are conservative. And so to get their views and for them to see their advertising, they've got to veer right. And looking at the issue of multicultural sort of who the media, who the advertisers are focusing on, right? The U.S. The Alliance for Inclusive and Multicultural Marketing in 2019 gave a report on this, on who they're focusing on, and it's the racial disparities of who they advertise to. And what they found was that people of color, Hispanics, Blacks, and Asians, they didn't include Native Americans, but constitute 37.2% of the population. This was in 2019, but only 5.1% of the advertising dollars are focused on them, right? And the rest are focused, the rest of the advertising dollars, which I guess is 95%, are focused on white Americans. And so I think the breakdowns are Hispanics are 18% of the population. Only 3.6% of advertising dollars are allocated to reaching them. Blacks are 13.4% of the population, but only 1.4% of advertising dollars are allocated to them. And Asian Americans are 5.8%, but only 0.1% zero advertising dollars are dedicated to them. And so this focus primarily on a white audience for advertising dollars. It gives you a big idea why someone, a reporter, will not name that the problem is white American Republican voters are the problem, or their real concern about, you know, Biden in any way sort of making them upset by naming what they're doing, right? This is a big problem as far as how we can actually be heard. In 2019, Black professionals in advertising issued a call for change and demanded urgent action from agency leadership and they cited the recent murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, and that has brought, I'm reading from their statement here, has brought millions of Americans to the street in righteous protest. Once again, you know, these concerns are, you know, that they want advertising agencies to begin really focusing on allocating funds and representation to Black Americans, and the role this plays in how our issues are covered, because the Black Lives Matter issue has been the main way in which change has been happening. Certainly Native people have felt that. I was very active on the mascot issue, but we weren't able to carry that issue, the American Indian community, nationally. It was really because of Black Lives Matter, calling out first Confederate statues and then also representation of Native people, of oppressors of Native people, and then that sort of then also bleeded into questioning mascots again, right? And that really was really altered that, and so and really made it unacceptable to use mascot Native Americans for teams at the local school level, public school level, or even at the multi-million dollar franchises. When I go through these things, I'm just so frustrated with my colleagues as far as how are they able to understand this issue. I think it's been very frustrating for me to view that in the same way it's been frustrating for scientists working on climate change. You know, I think another one I listened to recently was The Stakes, which is from New York Times, the run-up, their podcast. That was a very frustrating listen to, because it's like, I don't know if they're willfully blind or if they really are blind, but their inability to articulate what's going on, I find incredibly offensive. And to this day, the majority of media in this country are composed of white Americans, and it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. I feel like, for me, those things will not change without a real structural change, which is what Black Lives Matter were addressing, which is, how do we change the structure so that we're not being the victims and the focus of violence? And part of changing those structures is critiquing the origin stories of those social structures, which include white supremacy, and using the data that supports that this is actually happening, and from research on redlining and to research on police brutality, you know, this is, you know, even recent stories I've seen about how even a well-to-do black couple were trying to sell their house, and when they got a $300,000 less sort of estimate for the value of the house, when they have their white friends of theirs go and present themselves as the owners, the value went up. And so this is all money that's being and being stolen from black families, the wealth that they could grow, and being given to white families. And without this, you know, without centering that and really analyzing it, and not backing away and not letting you know, Republican strategists, you know, just begin to sort of talk over that analysis, and present their talking points that are often unrelated to what's really happening in their own party, you know, which is that the MAGA Republicans have taken over. They can't stop it, even when they throw millions of dollars trying to stop those candidates.